My name is Ivan Gaskell of Harvard University, and this is a lecture delivered at the College Art Association annual meeting in Los Angeles on February 26th, 2009, my birthday. And it's called Sublime Damage. Few human-made things retain for long the precise form and appearance they had when new. Things change. The causes are various. Some pigments are sensitive to light and fade with prolonged or repeated exposure, certain pigments in dyes and paints, for instance. Some objects are worn by the repeated friction of human use. Some are degraded over a long term by exposure to the elements, or the chemical effects of burial in the earth or submersion in swamp or ocean. Some are damaged more suddenly, whether by deliberate human action, by accident, or by force of nature. The variety of the character of such changes, and of the efficient causes of those changes, is immense. In considering artworks in museums that have suffered damage, we think of conservation. Conservation encompasses a range of practices, a spectrum including craft and scholarship, in which analytical scientists and conservators specializing in various media participate according to their particular skills. Curators inevitably work closely with conservators and analytical scientists to care for the artworks in their charge. The criteria according to which curators and conservators make decisions with regard to artworks are empirical and pragmatic. I would describe the orthodoxy, from which there are many deviations, to be as follows. Works at a minimum should be consolidated and stabilized, that is, further degradation should be arrested. Areas of damage or decay that distract from the overall inferred intended effect of the appearance of the artwork should be corrected using reversible means. Acquired attributes of the artwork that do not so distract need not be repaired on the grounds that they attest to the durational life of the object. That is, features implying the passage of time to a viewer can enrich that viewer's sense of the artwork as a thing with its own history of changes. Underlying these ideas are certain premises, the first being that, and I quote, "the goal of art conservation is to present the artwork as the artist intended it to be seen," the words of Stephen Dykstra, who is exceptional among conservation scholars in having made a serious attempt to address theoretical issues involved in conservation. Even though the philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe demonstrated long ago that intention will not go away if we are to discuss human action, I hope to show that neither is intention the sole nor necessarily even the prime factor we should take into account when discussing the lives of artworks, at least intention as it is usually conceived when applied to artworks, of forming and fulfilling a schema. As a matter merely of convenience, not analysis, I propose to describe damaged artworks under three descriptions. 1. Sometimes curators and conservators judge an artwork to be so compromised by the damage it has sustained as to be irredeemable. In such cases, insufficient remains of the original appearance of the object to allow a viewer to reconstruct it in the mind's eye when prompted by the results of a conservator's intervention. In museums, such objects tend to remain study rather than exhibition pieces. 2. Sometimes an artwork comes into the hands of curators and conservators in a state that allows modification, not to the extent of wholly concealing its degradation, but which not only stabilizes it, but ostensibly improves its appearance, so that the unconcealed or unrepaired damage no longer distracts so severely from the remaining integrity of the artwork. That is, conservators repair or restore it partially and selectively. 3. Sometimes an artwork can be irreparably damaged, yet curators judge it to retain sufficient characteristics to allow a viewer successfully to make an imaginative reconstruction of it in the mind's eye, even without obvious conservation intervention. Constraints of time necessarily confine me to one example, which is of the third category. In doing so, I want to shift the focus away from the purposes and aims of conservation practice in order to examine aspects of the character of degradation itself, in particular what we might call its positive aspects. I want to introduce what the philosopher with whom I've been discussing this set of puzzles for some time now, A.W. Eaton, and I have come to call the aesthetics of degradation. In particular, I want to explore how this set of puzzles might relate to the sublime. Before introducing my case study, I invite you to bear in mind a reflection on damage by one of the great 19th century New England thinkers, Henry David Thoreau, from his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers of 1849. I quote, "There is a soberness in a rough aspect, as of unhewn granite, which addresses a depth in us, but a polished surface hits only the ball of the eye. The true finish is the work of time and the use to which a thing is put. The elements are still polishing the pyramids. Art may varnish and gild, but it can do no more. A work of genius is rough hewn from the first, because it anticipates the lapse of time, and has an ingrained polish, which still appears when fragments are broken off, an essential quality of its substance. Its beauty is at the same time its strength, and it breaks with a luster." My case study is an irreparably damaged artwork, yet judged by the curators who acquired it to retain sufficient original characteristics to allow a viewer successfully to make an imaginative reconstruction, even without obvious conservation intervention. In 1996, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York, purchased the Torso of a High General. Egyptian, it dates from the 4th century BC. It is fashioned from greywacke, a metamorphic rock prone to splitting along planes. The torso is life-size, and to my eye, it exhibits an arresting quality of carving, abrasion, and polish, rendering subtleties of flesh and musculature, notably in the abdomen, left shoulder, and arm. Also striking is the torsion of the hips beneath the garment, suggesting a confident forward stride. We learn from the curators writing in the issue of the Metropolitan Museum of Art Bulletin devoted to recent acquisitions in 1995-96, Marsha Hill and Joe Naruz, that the work dates from the reign of Nectanebo I, who ruled between 380 and 362 BC, and was the first pharaoh of Egypt's last native dynasty. The inscription on the back pillar describes the subject as the first generalissimo of His Majesty. The general's name is unfortunately lost, but the surviving part of the inscription tells us of his, and I quote, "driving away the aliens from the one who is on the throne, and restoring the village that had come to harm done by foreign lands." This may refer to the defeat of a combined Persian and Greek invasion force sent by the Persian Artaxerxes II to return Egypt to Persian domination. Hill and Aruz surmise that this statue may have originally stood in one of the temples mentioned in the inscription, either of Osiris in the Delta or at Abydos. The general contributed to the restoration of both. They further note that the work epitomizes the revival of the traditional striding kilted figure in the 4th century BC, a type that had disappeared during the period of Persian domination beginning 200 years previously. They evidently value the work as a fine example of the reassertion of a traditional type that they describe as elegantly simple and assertively physical with a bold beauty. They invite us to esteem the piece because of its traditional, purely Egyptian character, uncontaminated by foreign influence. This is all most interesting, but what strikes me is that, except to regret the loss of the general's name, they make no mention of, or even allusion to, the single most striking attribute of the work as we see it, that is, the damage it has sustained. At some unknown time, the torso suffered a catastrophic blow that sheared it diagonally between the left shoulder and the right hip, obliterating the head, right shoulder and arm, and the right side of the chest. Serious damage is not altogether unknown among surviving Egyptian and other ancient statuary, as the quartzite head of a king identified as either Necténebo I, whom the striding general served, or his namesake successor, currently on loan to the Metropolitan Museum from a private collection, attests. Yet the curators are silent in the face of irredeemable and wholly unconcealable damage. We might choose to regard this damage as a misfortune about which there is nothing to be said. After all, since the Renaissance, Western connoisseurs have become used to appreciating rediscovered classical statuary in damaged condition, and even to expect revered antique sculpture to be damaged. Westerners are heirs to a climate of reception sympathetic to damage in statuary originating in or otherwise evoking antiquity. Furthermore, damage is a sign not only of classical pedigree, but of mutability. It reminds Western viewers that artworks do not endure unchangingly. Damage evokes the vanity of human wishes and the fall of empires. All of this remains unsaid of the torso of a high general. What is said, at least by the curators, is that this is a robust work of art exemplifying the revival of pure Egyptian cultural values. But I propose that we can also choose to regard it otherwise, by embracing the damage that the torso has sustained as an integral aspect of the artwork as it is now, open to our aesthetic experience. I want to put it to you that the sheared fragment now constituting the artwork in the Metropolitan Museum is arresting in a way that the statue, when whole, could never have been. As Thoreau wrote, with Egypt in mind, it anticipates the lapse of time and has an ingrained polish which still appears when fragments are broken off, an essential quality of its substance. Yet this is not how the torso is usually presented in the gallery in the Metropolitan Museum devoted to the art of the last Egyptian dynasties. In the light of the curator's comments, its present appearance implies not a desire to preserve the damage that has occurred, rather resignation in the face of an inability to restore it adequately, and a reluctance to dilute the authentic remnant. The reason for not intervening further is, in a word, impotence. In such cases, curators acquiesce by finding consolation in the informed viewer's propensity to imagine the work whole in the mind's eye, while valuing the authenticity of what remains. Conservators acquiesce, often reluctantly, by reconciling themselves to the limits placed on the exercise of their powers of reconstruction by curatorial instruction, no less than in consequence of their own prudent reflection. I believe we can reliably infer that curators' and conservators' fundamental response to the damaged state of such an artwork is one of regret. Regret that the work is damaged at all, and regret that they are incapable of returning it to its original state. I believe there is much to be said for responding differently, for embracing the damage this artwork has sustained. I'm not proposing that the torso is necessarily any more valuable aesthetically, historically, or in other registers because of its current obviously damaged state than it would be had it retained its original physical integrity. But I am proposing that it is equally valuable as it is, not in spite of, but because of that damage. I now want to try to justify this claim. This claim might be viable within the terms of familiar premises governing the way that most Westerners view artworks, but I believe that it is greatly strengthened if we consciously adopt different premises. I shall mention only one, which is to think of art as perduring, and subject to what I and A.W. Eaton have termed exaptation, adopting a term from evolutionary biology. That is, the making, original condition, and first use of artifacts as artworks, while worthy of attempts at definition, have no necessary precedence in the face of subsequent states and uses. Use in museums is in many cases one such form of exaptation. We can associate the damage to this artwork, even if, and we cannot tell this to be the case, it was inflicted deliberately, with inadvertence rather than original fashioning. In a sense, what we see when witnessing the degradation of such an artwork is the human-made in the process of returning to nature. This is scarcely a novel observation, but is worth pursuing. It turns on the Aristotelian distinction between the natural and the artificial. Things in nature, the natural, occur without human contrivance, whereas artificial things are human-made. This distinction has come under increasing pressure, especially in recent years. For instance, the extent of the human impact on the environment is being reassessed, both materially and in terms of cultural investment in natural features. Again, the biochemical underpinnings of human neurological functions increasingly materialize the human mind. Recent research on the origins of humanity among hominins casts doubt on the continued viability of drawing a useful distinction between humans and others, with all that this implies for human particularity. The connection some anthropologists and early historians propose between what they term corporal culture and material culture threatens any distinction between hominin nature on the one hand and culture on the other. Further, in the present, human interventions in the genetic structures of living things blur any such distinction. We shall have cause to return to the ambiguities surrounding this distinction between nature and artifice, but for the present, having signalled its equivocal character, I shall employ it. This is because any post-Kantian discussion of the aesthetic qualities of things natural and things artificial depends on it. Indeed, the definitions Immanuel Kant proposes in his Critique of Judgment of 1790 are those that still prevail in many people's minds, even without their necessarily realizing the origins of those assumptions. It is for this reason, and because Kant's thought is the mountain we must pass over to get to the other side, that I mention Kant's ideas, not because I'm a Kantian myself. The distinction between things in nature and human-made things is fundamental to Kant's conception of aesthetic judgment. Kant distinguishes the artificial from nature as having been conceived by its maker with an end. Within the category of the artificial, he further distinguishes art from science as being the result of the application of a practical rather than a theoretical faculty, and from handicraft as the result of play as opposed to labour. Further, on Kant's account, agreeable arts are those that aim merely at sensations of enjoyment, whereas beautiful arts afford pleasure as kinds of cognition. In his words, "Beautiful art is a kind of representation that is purposive in itself, and, though without an end, nevertheless promotes the cultivation of the mental powers for sociable communication." Further, "In a product of art, one must be aware that it is art and not nature. Yet the purposiveness in its form must still seem to be as free from all constraint by arbitrary rules as if it were a mere product of nature." I have reminded you of these fundamental Kantian distinctions between artifice and nature, and within the artificial between beautiful art and other human constructs, because it may prove unavoidable to consider a damaged artwork as embodying the characteristics of both an artwork and a thing in nature. It may be an artwork insofar as it is human-made and conforms to Kantian or other definitional criteria. It may be a thing in nature insofar as its damage, even if caused purposefully by human intervention, reveals first the inherent naturalness of its material components and, second, its propensity to return to a state of nature. Insofar as it is a thing in nature, it may exhibit aesthetic characteristics proper to this condition. Insofar as it is a human-made thing, an artwork in this instance, it may exhibit characteristics proper to that condition. On this Kantian account, it can therefore exhibit two species of aesthetic characteristics simultaneously, that of the human-made artwork and that of the thing in nature. The most pressing question that then arises is, are we able to distinguish between these two species of aesthetic characteristic in the course of our examination of the object, or are they either wholly indistinguishable, other than theoretically, or are they partially or wholly coincident? Inner constitutive material, that is, nature revealed through what we might think of as exposures rather than losses, exhibits aesthetic characteristics. We have seen Thoreau draw attention to this phenomenon. Do these natural aesthetic characteristics differ in kind from those exhibited by artifacts that result from human ingenuity, acts of artistry? Even if they do, how can we accurately and reliably distinguish between them? The philosopher Arthur Danto reminds us of St. Augustine's claim that we can choose to regard anything, the teeth of a dead dog, from an aesthetic viewpoint. We can take the teeth of a dead dog to be things in nature. When considering things in nature, however, we are no more confined to the aesthetic category of the beautiful than we are when considering artifacts. Indeed, we may find that the sublime prevails, as may be the case in St. Augustine's example. Thus, the aesthetic characteristics of the natural elements exposed in the torso of a high general through damage and degradation are more properly sublime than they are beautiful. In Kant's words, proofs of the dominion of nature given by its destructiveness and in the enormous measure of its powers against which his own, the percipient's, vanishes away to nothing. I should mention that in evoking the sublime, I am not proposing an uncritical resuscitation of 18th-century European aesthetic categories. Rather, I am acknowledging that the concept of beauty has become so elastic as to lose all precision. Kant's demonstration that intersubjective consensus is harder to establish in the case of the sublime than in that of the beautiful in nature need not detain us. A viable description of the pertinent aesthetic characteristic of the phenomenon in nature, degradation, that we're examining, is what concerns us, and that may conveniently, if provisionally, be termed sublime. The exposure of the inner natural core of the Egyptian torso reveals the frailty of natural materials as configured by human beings in the face of natural forces, whether with human involvement or not, that wholly overwhelm their own powers. This would seem to be the salient aesthetic characteristic of areas of damage and degradation. However, I think we would be wrong to believe that during the act of perception we readily distinguish between human-made aesthetic characteristics on the one hand and natural ones on the other. Even when we do, we would be mistaken if we assumed that we register them and respond to them discreetly. Rather, we see them and think of them in relation to each other. In the damaged artifact, the area of damage only has salience in relation to what remains undamaged. Similarly, as Westerners, we cannot dissociate damage in appropriate artworks from its function as a sign not only of classical pedigree, but of mutability. It reminds Western viewers that artworks do not endure unchangingly. To complicate matters further, damage also has its place in the aesthetics of modernism. As it happens, this can be demonstrated using the torso itself, for it has been removed from its usual site among the late dynastic art of Egypt and placed with other works acquired in the mid-1990s in the exhibition commemorating the career of the recently retired director of the museum, the Philippe de Montebello years. A brilliant curatorial stroke in an exhibition that might otherwise be thanklessly intractable has juxtaposed the torso with, on one side, the first marble version of Constantin Brancusi's Bird in Space of 1923, an icon of modernism, and on the other, an evening gown evoking a Greek Hymettion designed by Alex Gray in 1965. Both confirm the amenability of the torso to be viewed in its damaged state in terms of classical modernism. Swiftly acknowledging the role that such familiar considerations, from vanitas to high modernism, might play in shaping our responses to a damaged artwork such as our case study, we might ask whether the distinction between artifice and nature truly is the key to understanding the processes involved. Are the aesthetic qualities of such damaged artworks a complex combination of all these kinds? Even if they are empirically distinct, are they distinct theoretically? Are these the qualities that exist in a tension irresolvable until nature has wholly reclaimed the artifact? Is that tension the principal source of our fascination with the artwork as a thing degraded? For reasons that may now be apparent, I suspect that the matter is rather more complex, and that our habitual distinction between the natural and the artificial, nature and the human-made, may even be misleading. When we consider an artifact, even an artifact in the process of seemingly being reclaimed by nature, human purposiveness is never absent, just as natural functions are never absent from what induces that purposiveness. In some instances, at least, the exposure of the natural is the consequence of purposive human action. Nature exposed, offering aesthetic characteristics empirically different from the human-made, is not the fundamental condition. Rather, it is the presence or absence of human purposiveness in the inducement of the conditions in which those natural aesthetic characteristics of the object can be discerned. To the extent that we choose to preserve damage, that we choose to honour it, and that we choose to value it in relation to what remains whole, that damage is humanly purposive. Degradation is a fundamental evident of the perdurance and exaptation of the object, and as such, an element in the use to which it is put by humans, even as its use changes again and again. I hope I have demonstrated that regret at the degraded state of artworks is not the only reasonable response, and that one day we might see such things profitably and provocatively exhibited to demonstrate my criterion of art as perduring and exapted, learning from Thoreau's insight that the true finish is the work of time and the use to which a thing is put.